is tape 3, the afternoon of January 7th. Would you repeat that, Mr. President, about Columbus that you said before we got this
well,
out? Well,
astronomers,
I think, has a point.
And geographers had long contended, way 2,000 years before Columbus made his tour, that the world was a planet that was round like the rest of them, but nobody believed it. In fact, Galileo was made to retract what he believed as was true so far as the Earth being a circular planet, and retracted what he had to say. Columbus believed in it, and he worked his head off until he finally got the Queen of Spain to support him in the trip to the West Indies. And then he didn't know where he'd been. He thought he'd been to the Indies. And that's the reason we call the inhabitants of this continent, this Western Hemisphere, Indians, because Columbus thought he'd reached India. And of course, there's an old fellow named Amerigo Vespucci who tried his best to make it appear that Columbus didn't know where he was going, and that's the reason the continents on this hemisphere are called America. They should have been called Columbia.
What you're saying is that it's all right to have theory, but it's the doer who produces.
That's right. You can have all the theories you want, and they're not worth a hoot unless somebody puts them into effect. And that's just as true today as it ever has been. That's true of every invention that's been made. The explosive engine, the steam engine, and everything of that kind had to be put into effect after a theorist had decided it was possible. Then somebody had to be willing to go ahead and risk his reputation on making it work, and that's true of everything that takes place.
So the environment here was just made order for the thing to explode all over the place, invention and...
That's true. The inventions in this country have added tremendously to the welfare of the world, as they have in other countries after it was found that the freedom of thought was necessary to get those things done.
But our population also grew at that time astronomically. It was just exploding all over the place. And in addition to that, during that brief period, some 11 or 15 million immigrants were allowed to come into this country from all parts.
Yes, from 1840 to 1890, that was true. After that, they put
blocked it, eh?
That's right.
Was it because we could no longer assimilate them, or was this the result of labor intervening because...
Well, it was a result of both capital and labor intervening because they thought that the resources of the country were exhaustible and that we should be careful not to have too many people here to develop them, but they were wrong.
They're making an exclusive club out of the country.
That's what they wanted to do, and didn't work.
Well...
It hasn't worked up to date.
And at the same time, we were pushing for ever higher tariffs, too, excepting as Democrats got into office.
Well, they were working for the situation that a monopoly always wants. They want to, when they come to the point where they can make a profit, they want the situation closed up so nobody else can make one. And that's why the protective tariff was put on. It was supposed to protect industry. Well, all it did was to build up trust, and then when they got too great, well, they had to knock them down with the interstate commerce law and two or three others.
Yes, the anti-Sherman Act came through during the...
That's right, 1890, 92 or 3.
Well, we're on that particular point, Mr. President. Is it your feeling that today the such thing as the Sherman Antitrust Act achieves anything? No one's ever enforced it to the extent that it really has broken up any monopoly outside.
Yes, it has. Yes, it has, Bill.
What would you
it's
want?
Been enforced and can be enforced again when we have people in charge of the situation that really want it enforced. Now, the split up of the Standard Oil Company and the fact that the railroad monopoly at the time of 1888 to 90, that's when the Interstate Commerce Commission was set up. Then the Sherman Antitrust Act came along after that in the early 90s, and that prevented absolute control of the industrial setup of the country. And then it was enforcement of it was loosened, and it goes up and down like that all the time. But there isn't any reason in the world why the Sherman Antitrust Act And the Anti-Monopoly Act can't still be enforced if it becomes necessary.
What did you say? Well, is it your opinion, Mr. President, that it is better to have less efficiency rather than complete monopoly in the
hands of big... Well, if you're going to have complete monopoly, the first thing you have is government control of everything, and that's not what we want. We want the individuals to have freedom of action. And when the freedom of action comes to the point where a few control that freedom of action, then the government has to take over with the Sherman Antitrust Act and with the other things that have been accomplished under our free government to get people to understand that we believe that competition is the life of trade. In Britain and a great many of the other countries, they believe that monopoly is the life of trade.
Well, you're suggesting, Mr. President, that a complete monopoly would lead to government taking over?
There isn't any question about it. Complete monopoly would necessarily lead to the communist form of government or to complete socialism.
That's a very interesting observation. So, in the early stages, we had no controls at all, and we gave the railroads and all the various companies like the Standard Company and the oil people complete and unbridled freedom of action.
That's right.
Now, that resulted in some terrible inequities, but it also produced some extraordinary developments.
Yeah, there's no question about that, but when they got too powerful, then the power had to be taken away from them by the people, or they would have controlled the people instead of the people controlling the monopoly.
And the important point that you're making, I've seldom heard it made, is that when you get a complete monopoly, when you get complete control, it's necessary for the government to step in, and in that case, the government control would virtually amount to socialist or...
If it was continued. But that never was the case. The objective was to have the government interfere when the monopolies got too powerful. And it has to be done.
But that's
you're
warning that any turn to monopoly will lead to monopoly by government.
That's right. Monopoly by government and either socialism or communism. And they're both the same.
Yeah, well, the president had been making another point in the years gone by, and that is when you get business so almighty big and so entrenched, then instead of the government controlling business controls the government.
That's
then
right. And that's what we've got to stop, because this is a government of the people and not the government of monopoly. And when business gets too big, then they begin to get the big head and they try to control the government, and the best thing to do is to bust them up, and that's what's happened in our history.
And if you allow them not only to control the government but get so big, then the government taking over is necessary.
Absolutely. The government doesn't necessarily have to take over, but it has to break them up. And that's what's happened in the standard oil monopoly, and that's what happened in the railroads. And it'll have to happen again when the business gets too big for spritzes, then it's got the first spritzes, then it's got
the... What his administration did do was to give them their head and turn them loose, go ahead, the privilege, and as soon as they began to abuse the privilege, the government had to step in and curb them.
That's correct.
Do you mean to say the government gave them their head, or they just...
The government winked at them, apparently.
They took it.
They assumed it.
And then they had to be regulated, and that's the reason for all these regulatory agencies. And those agencies are supposed to be branches of the legislative arms of the legislative branch of the government, and to enforce the programs that the laws provide. And when they cease to be that, then they belong to monopoly.
Well, wouldn't it be a natural transition here, Mr. President, Dave, to get to Theodore Roosevelt, who succeeded McKinley and who is known as a trust buster and a man who astoundingly began to realize the great danger
He made a great publicity stunt out of being a trust buster, but he busted very few of them. Until Woodrow Wilson became president of the United Roosevelt. Was one of the reasons why he became president. That's the greatest thing he did, when he contributed to the election of President Woodrow Wilson.
Not willingly.
No. But then he was really of the opinion that the big anomalies ought to be controlled. And they were not thoroughly and completely controlled until Wilson became president. And then when Harding succeeded him, well, they let a lot of the things Wilson advocated go out the window, and Franklin Roosevelt put them back when he became president.
Actually, we've confused control with a thing that we call now regulation. And here now regular consistency of it comes in. We've tried to break up these big monopolies. We've succeeded in a good many cases. We broke up, the government always won their case with but few exceptions. And the people
very rarely
got relief. This is the cost didn't go down as these monopolies got broken up.
Been broken up.
I'm asking a question.
If they hadn't been broken up, they would have been a complete monopoly. And the very fact that they were broken up, some of the greatest instruments that we have today were struck out today. Its program under Wilson was put into effect.
But how do you explain this situation where the government now and under all the recent administrations, when two reasonably big contested fields tried to join, the justice, they can't do it, and they've prevented a great many mergers, although during this administration, a great many took place. And yet the greatest of all monopolies, AT&T, and a great many of these utilities just go on forever.
Well, AT&T is heading exactly in the direction, if continues to increase the cost of communication. First thing you know, the government's going to take it over, and it'll be a government monopoly, which it is in every other country in the world but this.
Well,
that's interesting, Mr. President. Can you develop that a little bit?
Well, look at the situation now. We used to have independent telephone companies. We used to have two in this neighborhood right here. And that AT&T finally took it over, the Southwestern Bell Telephone Company. And the situation has developed all around the country in the same way. And they are increasing the cost of communication to the individual. And the reason they're increasing it is because they say that the price of things have gone up and they have to have more money to take care of it. And the first thing you know, they're going to increase the situation to the point, and they have absolute monopolistic control of all the communications in the country, so far as talking over the telephone is concerned. They're going to come to the point where people are going to get tired of it. The first thing you know, we're going to have a telephone monopoly in charge, in which the government will be completely in charge. And that's not the best thing for the country.
Despite the claim of AT&T and the telephone people that so many million stockholders, the great public...
Well, the only reason they've got the so many million stockholders is to prevent the very thing that I'm talking about from taking place.
And yet, there's absolutely, when you have a monopoly, there's absolutely no reason why you should keep on splitting your stock, increasing your dividend, because the public pays the dividend.
There's no question about that. The public pays the price for communication.
That's a very interesting theory.
This is tape 3 the afternoon of January 7th. This is tape 4 the afternoon of January 7th, 1961. President, we're starting to talk about Theodore Roosevelt and
the Roosevelt dynasty.
Well, Theodore Roosevelt was always very highly thought of by both Franklin Roosevelt and Mrs. Franklin Roosevelt. She always called him Uncle Ted, and whenever the opportunity presented itself, she was always telling me something about what Uncle Ted did, and he did a great many things that were for the welfare and benefit of the country. When his panic came along in 1907, he went to see J.P. Morgan, and Morgan controlled the situation. And then Teddy was a very great anti-monopolist, and he did a very great many things that were in the public interest as I see it. And of course, I was not on his side. But I've always thought that the greatest thing he ever did was when he split the Republican Party and caused the election of Woodrow Wilson, who was one of the greatest of the great presidents.
Now, you said something about his going to call on J.P. Morgan. Wasn't it more proper for the president to call the banker into the White House?
Well, I My recollection is that he had a session with Morgan and the Wall Street controllers of the money power at that time. And, of course, everybody in the country thought he went to see Morgan. I don't know whether he went to see him or whether Morgan came to see him.
Well, the record shows they did go to see him when he tried to float a loan of $300 million or something like that.
Well, I don't know whether he went to see him
or not. Tried to borrow that much money.
He finally got J.P. Morgan to take things over and try to stop the panic of 1907, which was done.
Mr. President, Roosevelt, aside from his trust-busting things, always remembered as a man who took the Panama Canal or the Isthmus of Panama.
Well, there was an effort on the part of the government of the United States to make a treaty with Colombia, which was the government that controlled the Isthmus of Panama. And when that could not happen, Teddy engineered a revolution in Panama and took over the situation, and that's how he came to build the canal.
And so in 1903, Panama ceded the canal zone, a strip 10 miles wide, through lease and sale to the United States.
That's right. And we built the canal. I think it cost us $300 million.
And in 1904, Panama Canal Zone formally was acquired by the United States. Then I note here that President Roosevelt issued a corollary to the Monroe Doctrine defending American intervention in Latin America to stop European aggression. That was in 1904, because at that time he was still mixing in our...
He was still mixing in 1902 in the Venezuelan
situation. That's what I was going to say. In 1902, we'd intervened in the Venezuelan dispute again with European nations, but December 2nd, 1904, President Roosevelt issued this corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. And then, of course, he played a role in the Russo-Japanese Peace Treaty. He brought that
That's up. Right. He brought him over to Portland, Maine, I think, and was successful in getting them to stop hostilities. And that's how he got that award from the peace people.
Yes, he was the first president to get the Nobel Prize.
Nobel Prize, yes. Indeed.
Well, he intervened in the Russo-Japanese War, did he not?
His intervention was to get the two together and try to stop hostilities, which they finally did.
At Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Portsmouth. I thought it was Portsmouth, Maine. Portsmouth, New Hampshire. They're right there together. They're close together.
Yeah. Yes.
Would you consider that a wise intervention at the time he did?
Oh, yes. He stopped people from getting killed, and I thought it was all right, and everybody did. Everybody thought it was the proper thing to do.
But actually, he served the interests of the Japanese more so than he did the Russians. The Japanese, by that time, were pretty tired and pretty well exhausted.
The Japanese never thought so. They never thought he served their interests. They thought that he kept them from taking over Siberia, which they eventually did anyway.
Well, pretty well exhausted. No, the Japanese never divorced, I think.
They did eventually in 1931.
Yeah.
They did in 1931. That's what they intended to do at that time. And they claimed that Theodore Roosevelt kept them from attaining their program, which was to take over the colony north of...
Manchuria.
That was what they wanted. And he kept them from doing that. Got them and the Russians to come to an agreement.
But
although the Russians
the students are pointing to the fact that the Russians were, but so were the Japanese, exhausted, and that they couldn't have gone on at that point beyond where they'd already gone.
They've always claimed that they could have taken Manchuria if Roosevelt had let them alone. And I think they could have.
Yes.
Well, see, eventually they did. And we had set them back on their heels.
Well,
did
this serve the interests of peace and humanity, or was there some national interest that was involved in our intervention?
No, I think the objective of Theodore Roosevelt was to stop the war and to serve the interests of peace and the welfare of both nations. Although the Japs always thought that he kept them from getting Manchuria in the first place. And in 1931, if you remember, over the protest of Stimson, they took it anyway. And then they had to give it back after we set up the United Nations.
Well, and all this period of the Russo-Japanese maneuvering, which led to the war, involved also both the Russian ambition to get into Korea, which Japan controlled, And when Russia was stopped at that time from expanding further and getting down into Korea, it merely postponed, I think, for several decades, almost a half century later, when you were faced with the problem of Korea and Russian desire and the communist desire to get down in Korea. So
that's
almost in this Roosevelt period.
Right. And if the Russians had won the naval battle in the China, East China Sea, they would have taken Korea, and the Japs would have been defeated. But the Japanese beat them in their own game, and then Roosevelt interfered, if I remember correctly, and got them to sign a peace
treaty. Vladivostok, wasn't it? Yeah, I guess so.
No, no, the battle was in the China Sea, south of Korea, where the Russian fleet was defeated by...
Port Arthur.
Port Arthur, I'm sorry.
Yes,
sorry. Sorry.
That's
Port
well,
Arthur. That's it.
We'll have to get a map for
that short. I visualize it. The point you made about Henry Stimson, he was then Secretary of State in the Hoover administration.
He was Secretary of State in the Hoover administration and advised that the Japs should not be allowed to go into Korea.
He advocated intervention in that affair by the United States.
His intervention was in this way, that he wanted us to warn the Japs to stay out of there. And I imagine they stayed out.
Also suggested at the time was that the American fleet be sent there to show the flag in order to discourage the Japanese from doing that, but Hoover was afraid to take any risk.
Well, they didn't take any risk, I don't think.
Was Hoover acting on his own, or was there another group
well,
within
I
the government?
I think Britain was against it.
Well, what is interesting is that in 1907, Roosevelt sent the American battleships on an around-the-world cruise.
That's right.
Say then, Mr. President, in a sense that the Theodore Roosevelt administration had extended itself very greatly into foreign affairs, and America was making America a foreign power.
It was a contribution to making America a world power, let's put it that way.
Well, wasn't this done also to reaffirm by Roosevelt the validity of the Monroe Doctrine? So this was another emphasis.
I don't think he had the Monroe Doctrine in mind. I think he was anxious to show the world that we could take care of ourselves, and it made a good impression. Made a very good impression, you know, all the way around the world. He sent the American fleet around the world, if you remember.
Did he have some problem with the Congress at that time on that particular point?
Yes, the fleet was stuck in either Manila or Yokohama, and didn't have the money sent all around the world. And Roosevelt said he was going to send it anyhow, so they gave him the money.
Now, what is interesting, and this raises an important question, Mr. President, for me, I wonder if you could answer it. In 1908, Theodore Roosevelt made a gentleman's agreement with Japan, and Japanese declared they would issue no passport to laborers wishing to emigrate to the United States, and that was all part of the feeling about the
that was the
yellow...
Chinese-Japanese Exclusion Act in
yes.
conclusion. That's that. That is a part of it.
What is your feeling about that, Mr. President?
Well, of course, I wasn't old enough to pay much attention to it, but everybody in California and the West Coast thought it was a good thing.
Why?
Because they didn't want cheap labor in California or Oregon or Washington either.
But we've always overestimated the danger of getting more labor into the country. We've always suffered from not quite enough labor.
I know, but the man who can live on 2 cents a day can't compete with one that has to have $2 a day.
Well, he learns very quickly to live on a little better than that.
I know, but that was the reason it didn't.
That was the reason
I'm trying to get the president whether or not he approved of this particular act.
Well, he explained.
I wasn't old enough to do anything about it. Afterwards, when the same situation came up, we did everything we possibly could to get the Japanese and the Chinese treated on the same basis that our own American labor were treated.
What
that
is
took place in the western part of the country.
What is the situation with regard to the entry of Chinese and Japanese into the
United States? Still a restriction on them.
Still a restriction.
Yes, it's still a restriction.
And that's mainly, you believe, Mr. President, that is mainly an economic.
That's right, purely economic.
Because of the very fact that so many Americans, once exposed to the Japanese, married so many Japanese, it wasn't so much the question of race or color.
No, no. It's a case of their being able to live on a very much smaller basis for economic reasons than can our own people.
In California, the Japanese were so much more industrious, so much more capable as gardeners, that the people couldn't possibly compete with them. But now they've come up and everybody gets along with them fine. There's just no conflict of any kind.
Well, that is those who are here now.
Those who are here and have become Americanized, they're just as good.
But, you know, the reason for their not being able to compete with them is because the Americans in that line don't like to work. They want somebody else to do it for them. The Japanese and Chinese are willing to work like dogs in order to attain position which they know that they can attain by work.
And there are many backward peoples all over the continent here in Europe who have been working their heads off without proper rewards and would like to come over.
No
and
question.
And have
that.
Difficulty getting over here. And do you feel that emigration has always been over restrictive?
Oh, yes, I always thought so. That's the reason I was, I vetoed the McCarran bill for that very same reason. And then they passed it over my veto, and then they had to repeal a part of it.
Well, now, Roosevelt apparently, Theodore Roosevelt apparently favored restricted immigration.
Oh, yes. All of them did up to that time, and up to this time, they still are favored because of this strictly restriction on the entry of working people into this country from other countries.
It's a tariff on labor, so to speak.
That's right. That's what it is. And the laborers' favor, labor is the cause of us being there.
This is labor-agitated legislation.
That's right.
Well, this is...
And I don't blame them. I don't blame them. There'd be lower wages for them if that is allowed to happen.
This is the end of tape for the afternoon of January 7th.